Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and now we're in depth on why fewer kids are getting sex ed in school and what they're missing. When Peggy Ornstein was talking to young women for her newest book, Girls and Sex, she learned that there's plenty of sex ed going on out there, just not from the sources you'd want or expect. Ornstein writes that pornography provides sexual education for boys and girls, quote, "On the one hand, the girls I met knew that porn was about as realistic as pro wrestling, but that didn't stop them from consulting it as a guide." Which makes it all the more essential, doesn't it, that high-quality sex education is available. And yet a study this spring from the Guttmacher Institute found that significantly fewer teens were getting formal sex ed than in the mid-2000s. So as our guests join us, I'm interested in your view. What kind of sex ed do you want your kids to learn in school? Is it really just about the basics? Is it details about contraception? Should they learn about power and pleasure? How do you discuss this with your kids? So talk to me this morning about the sexual education that you'd like to have your kids learning in school. And then talk to me about what that ought to really encompass. Is it really just about anatomy and the basics and contraception? Is it about more than that? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Steph Curtis is at mprnews.org/live. We'll have a conversation going on there, and I'm on Twitter where I see a lot of you joining in already. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Dr. Leslie Walker is with us. She's the Division Chief of Adolescent Medicine at Seattle Children's Hospital, and she's a professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Washington School of Medicine. And she's with us from Seattle. Leslie, I wonder if first names are okay with you.
Yes, they are. Good morning,
Carrie. Good morning. Really good to have you with us. Al Vernacchio is with us. He's a sexuality educator at Friends Central School and the author of For Goodness Sex. And he's with us today from Philly. And Al, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Carrie. It's great to be here.
Leslie, is sex ed declining in school districts because of financial appropriations? Is this really a money decision, or is it because parents are pressuring schools to limit the curriculum?
I would imagine it's all of those things. I know, probably a decade or two decades ago, there were more people that were upset about what was being taught in the schools and wanting to have a lot of rules around what was being taught. But I think there's also been some economic issues, and, you know, whether or not a school district thinks this is essential probably has a lot to do with it as well.
Al, is that what's happened, that this is not viewed as essential, which is surprising? And we'll talk about why in a minute. But is this about money mostly?
I think Leslie's exactly right. I think that many school districts don't see sexuality education as a necessity, and that's to the detriment of the students that they serve.
And is that because that school districts will say, well, this is really the role of the parents? And is that right?
Well, parents are the primary sexuality educators of their kids. There's no doubt about that. But what we've seen over and over again is parents need help. And we need more than just parents involved. We need teachers. We need caring adults. We need a whole team approach to helping kids develop healthy sexuality.
Al, I'm curious about at what age you think sex ed ought to start, and then over what span of the student's life? Because the way it was when I was in school is you basically had a semester, I don't know, like in sixth grade or something, and then it was never mentioned again through the rest of high school.
Right. And I think too many school districts are still promoting that model. I think comprehensive sexuality education can start as early as nursery school. We can do age-appropriate education for young people, and that conversation has to continue through all of their schooling. We're sexual beings from birth to death, and so we need to know about healthy sexuality from our earliest days up into our later years.
Yeah, Leslie, is that where it gets a little uncomfortable for some parents, the idea that you'd be starting to educate about sexuality at a pretty young age?
I think when they don't understand what that means, it can be uncomfortable. But I know, I've worked in the past with fifth grade parents from a lot of diverse backgrounds, and about sexuality. And really, I like the word sexuality education better than sex, because it really encompasses the full range of what that means. And parents want tools. If they know what's going on at school, they can, you know, augment that with their belief systems at home. And I think we just have to be clear about, you know, what's important, what kids get, because they are, from the time they are born and, you know, around their parents, they're getting the messages. They're getting sexuality education. But you want to make sure that the messages they're getting from their family, from their media, from, you know, their surroundings, are the messages that will help them be healthy as they get older.
Yeah, Leslie, to that, what do you make of that quote that I read from Peggy Ornstein, who has a, wow, very illuminating chapter in her book about how early kids are exposed to pornography and how they're telling people that this is where they get a lot of learning about sexuality.
Yeah, I do think that that's probably always been a part, you know, and the magazines were behind the desk, you know, and in the little brown folders. And, you know, now it's on the internet and on the phones. Kids have iPads at, you know, age two. So, you know, you can get these images. And I do think that they are there. But also, you know, the images of how parents are interacting with each other at home, how they see their older siblings act with their romantic partners. Those are all messages they get. I think that the messages that they see from media or images that could be considered pornography can be very misleading for kids and actually, you know, very anxiety producing.
On Twitter here, Steve says sexuality education should encompass anatomy, contraceptives, and consent. And Honey tweets in and says, I'm 24. I learned sex ed for the first time in 10th grade in Louisiana, covered transmission, STDs, and safety. To the phones to Ricky in Northfield. Hi, Ricky. How are you thinking about this morning?
Good morning. I'm thinking in the sense of definitely have like a curriculum as a baseline for sex education for kids, but have like an advanced curriculum that's shared with parents, and parents can either participate with it and or give approval for it in that advanced curriculum they want the kids to learn about.
Yeah, so sending home information with parents that they could use to have these conversations?
Yes, yeah. That'd be great.
That's an interesting idea. Al, what do you think of that, and does that happen?
Well, it certainly happens in my classroom. I think that we need to see we teachers and educators need to see parents as allies and not adversaries, and that they are essential to the work that we do. So it is important in my class, for example, that students go home and talk to their parents about some of the issues we're covering in class. One of my assignments is that kids have to go home and ask either their parent or some trusted adult to tell the story of when they got the sex talk and what it was like, and to have the students compare that to what we're talking about in class about what might be appropriate when parents and children are talking about healthy sexuality.
Boy, that's such a good idea, Al. What do they tell me some of the stories that the kids come back with?
Well, a lot of the kids come back and say that the adult they spoke with said, I never had a sex talk.
Wow.
Or no one ever talked to me at all, which is very sad. And some come back and talk about talks that were very fear-based or very negative, or that portrayed sexuality as some kind of wild force that needs to be controlled. And I think we have to be really clear that when we do sexuality education, we start from the premise that sexuality is a force for good and is a really positive thing that enhances our humanity. We can't just talk about risk and prevention. We've got to talk about pleasure, and we've got to talk about the way that sexuality enhances our self and our relationships.
I think I should ask you why we can't just talk about risk and prevention. I think parents think, well, that's the priority. What else do kids really need to know?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think that when we focus only on risk and prevention, what we do is create an atmosphere that says that sexuality, we're missing all of the positive, all of the wonderful things. When I talk to parents, they're not just hoping that their kids remain disease-free or pregnancy-free. And I hope that too. But we're also looking for kids to have really successful relationships, to be able to talk to their partners, to be able to enjoy their bodies and feel positive about the deliberate consensual decisions they make. So that's got to be an essential part of what we're doing.
To the phones to Chris in Minneapolis. Hi, Chris. How's this playing out in your household?
Okay, so I'm a relatively young father. I've got a 15-year-old daughter. I'm 38 years old.
Uh-huh.
And luckily, my partner works for a clinic, unnamed, obviously. But to address the sex thing was cringing. I cringed just thinking about it. So I recently had her go get the shot to prevent pregnancy.
Uh-huh.
And I think it would be, like, super helpful if it was brought up in her school or something was sent to me saying, hey, you know, we discussed this in class this week, you know, or we just want you to know so you can be aware. Because, like, bringing up the subject was super hard. She cringed, I cringed. And bringing her into the clinic, my mother was going off, are you sure this is the right thing to do? It's almost like telling her she should have sex. And, you know, so I think, like, we address all types of other issues, drugs and violence and social. So I think, like, this is a huge part. What partner to choose?
Good to have your call. Leslie, to the cringing, you know, if parents can maybe handle this a little more, well, less cringingly, maybe they won't have kids who are feeling deeply uncomfortable about it. What would you say?
I'd say don't fear the cringe.
Good. Oh, really? I mean, don't fear it. Okay.
It's going to be there. I mean, it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to see your kids develop and move forward and reach out into the world and experience different things. It's uncomfortable for kids. You know, I work with teens and we talk alone. We always have a period of time where we talk alone. And some parents will bring their kids in and say, I want them here because I want you to talk about this because I can't talk about it.
And what do you say to that, though?
Try to begin the discussions together so that they begin to have a language together, that they can talk about it. Because, you know, a lot of times it's very tense and it's okay in the beginning to be tense. You know, it's something new. It's something that the parents most times have never been taught how to talk to their kids about it.
And,
you know, so I think it's a healthy thing to feel the cringe, get beyond it. It will help you with other difficult conversations because in the lifetime of raising and being, you know, mentors and caring people to our kids, there will be difficult conversations and we've got to learn how to have them.
This is something I want to talk to our listeners about here. So Leslie Walker is with us. She's a physician and division chief of adolescent medicine at Seattle Children's Hospital. And Al Vernacchio is with us. He's a sexuality educator at Friends Central School and the author of For Goodness Sex. And we asked them to join us today to have a conversation about the fact that fewer American students are getting sex education in schools. We talked a bit about that at the beginning of the conversation. We're also looking at what are they learning? What's the kind of relevant information that they're getting from parents, from some of the school curriculum, from the other places where they get information about sexuality? And I want to ask you this morning. I'm interested in how you feel about sexuality education in schools, but have you had that discussion with your kids? How did that go? I mean, yes, we'll concede that there might be some cringing going on, but tell me how you approached it. Maybe your experience will help some other parents out there saying, I just don't know how to begin. Or maybe you need a little bit of advice on how to begin, because you hear our guests saying it's very important that this happen in the home and at school. 651-227-6000 to tell me about these discussions you're having with your kids. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at @CarrieNPR, and where Kate says, my fourth grader is getting lessons, quote unquote, on school bus from boys watching internet porn. Schools and parents need to provide accurate information. Steph, off the page.
Diana says, I had a recently frustrating conversation in a group on Facebook that had a fair share of individuals who thought that parents should be the main educator and taxes shouldn't be spent introducing kids to such filth. Some individuals even indicated their parents knew nothing and they had to educate themselves, but that there's no need for publicly funded sex ed. And Heather says, I have a 9-year-old son who I've been talking with about sexuality, but I would also like to get him a good book. Do your guests have any suggestions for books for young boys?
Always go to the books. So, Al, books for young boys on sexuality.
Sure. There's so many. A book that I often recommend is Corey Silverberg's Sex is a Funny Word. It's appropriate for middle school-aged children on up. It's very comprehensive. It's beautifully illustrated with cartoons that kids can relate to. There's also a new book coming out in September by Andrew Smiley, and it's specifically targeted to boys, and it's all about boys' development and boys' understanding about sexuality. I'm unfortunately blanking on the title at the moment, but it'll come to me.
Yeah, we'll look that up, and actually that might be a good source for another conversation about this, Al. Leslie, what would you recommend? And maybe you'll chime in with books for some younger girls, too.
Well, I would actually also, the world is digital now, and mm-hmm. I do think that it's important to know some websites that have been, you know, longstanding and really good for kids. One would be Sex Etc. That one is really nice. It talks, it's very comprehensive. It doesn't really have a lot of judgment in there. It just kind of gives you the facts written by teenagers and experts. And another one, Scarleteen. With www.scarletteen.com is another place for both groups. I think, again, it's critical for both girls and young boys to begin to understand both sides, you know, both their gender identification as well as others.
Abir says on Twitter, someone please remind parents that half of y'all probably had sex, bad sex and unsafe sex, earlier than teens today. Chill out. And to the phones to Joy in Kenyon. Hi, Joy.
Hi.
Hey, what's happening? You have a 12-year-old daughter, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. So tell me about these conversations you're having.
So I have a background in medicine. I'm a medical assistant. And she came home one day, I think it was in third, fourth grade, and said, hey, we're starting to talk about sex. And I said, great, let me get you some books. So I pulled out my books, and we started talking about it. And, you know, I made it not scary.
How'd you do that?
And I had an anatomy coloring book. We brought that out, showed her the reproductive for both men and women. And I expressed that it wasn't an issue for me.
Okay.
So this is something she has to know about, that it's not scary. She should know about it, and she should take control over it.
Joy, good. So, thanks very much for the call. You've kind of raised a question I wanted to put to Leslie, which is, at what age, Leslie, is it appropriate to start talking about the balance of power in a relationship and in a sexual relationship, and pleasure, and some of those things that get beyond just the contraceptive and the anatomy and those things?
I think it's when the kids begin to ask the questions. So, you know, there's always what's important, I think, is being developmentally appropriate, not scaring kids with information before they're ready to hear it. But beginning, even, you know, children in elementary school are going to see power differentials in how, you know, parents and the parents and other adults in their lives and older youth react to each other. I think it's really critical early on to talk about power, respect, what it means to have a loving, wonderful sexual and relationship experience. It's important because it's something for them to look forward to get ready for, to begin to understand how to mature for that, rather than just throw a lot at them that may not really be relevant for them at the moment. I think pleasure in particular is something that I've always, you know, with curriculum that in the schools and, you know, even what we learn as pediatricians to talk to kids about around sexuality, pleasure is often missed. And that's actually really critically important, especially with power. You know, girls don't always know that that's something they should be expecting, or that the absence of may actually be a sign that there is a power issue.
Exactly.
Or, you know, so I think it's important for all of these things to be done. It takes a number of people. And I would add, besides home and school, the pediatrician's office is another important place. We just came out in the American Academy of Pediatrics with a renewed position on sexuality education for pediatricians to, again, you know, be reaffirmed that this is a place that kids come to as well as parents.
Jamie in Minneapolis. Hi. Hey, Jamie. Thanks for waiting.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I guess I wanted to raise the point that I think there are a lot of sexual issues that are getting politicized and are probably difficult for a lot of teachers to talk about in the classroom, like sexual violence and power or homosexual relationships, abortion, birth control. It might be difficult in some areas, in some classrooms, for them to have those conversations that I think are so important to add into this sex education conversation.
Al, do you think that's right? The politicizing of this gets in the way.
I do think that's right. And I think one of the things that people who are interested in having comprehensive sexuality education in schools need to think about are who gets elected to our school boards. School boards often set curricula, and we need to be very intentional about making sure that people who are going to be setting curricula in the public school systems are favorable to comprehensive sexuality education for all students. I think that's crucial. I want to also just quickly echo Leslie's recommendations for websites. Sex Etc. and Scarlet Teen are exactly the websites that I recommend to kids. And I have the title of that book. It's Dating and Sex, A Guide for the 21st Century Teen Boy. And it's Andrew Smiler, S-M-I-L-E-R. It's coming out in September.
Nicely done. Quick search there.
Thank
off
you.
Air, right? Hey, Al, just a quick question about the how to handle the spectrum of sexual experience. So you may have, I mean, when you get up into high school, 13, 14, 15-year-old kids who are starting to recognize that they might be gay or that there's a gender issue there, or how does the curriculum, how well does the curriculum reflect the spectrum of sexual identity these days?
I think that really depends on the school system that you're looking at and talking about. Certainly, every sexuality education curriculum should cover the entire range of gender identity, gender expression, sexual and romantic orientations. We need to normalize the fact that there are many ways that we identify who we are, many ways that we reach out to others with sexual and romantic attractions. And if we're not normalizing that, we're leaving kids out of conversations that are vital for them to have. And today, you know, every kid, well, most kids today are very comfortable talking about a range of gender identities and expressions. And for most kids today, sexual orientation is a non-issue. So it's really the adults who are cringing about this and worrying if this information is appropriate for kids. And kids are very comfortable talking about it and are very easy, very easily see that there are many ways to be human and many ways to love each other.
More comfortable, I think, Al, than their parents probably are.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Leslie, I was reading an NPR interview with a sex educator who works in the Bronx public schools, and she said that every single boy in her seventh grade classes had asked a very explicit question that came from exposure to pornography. And her quote was, "Kids are getting information about sex and examples of what sex looks like in a lot of different ways. How do we counteract that effect that pornography has and, I guess, too much exposure to pornography can have on everybody, not just kids?"
Yeah, I think by really looking at where are they getting this, knowing it, being educated, you know, from the parents to the doctor's offices to the, churches to schools, where all of those places kids get sexuality education, depending on where they are. You know, we need to be ready because those messages are there and they're, you know, it's a part of media, it's a part of marketing. They can be overwhelming. They can be, you know, exciting, just like kids like to watch horror movies or anything else that's, you know, a kind of exciting and different. But, you know, I think we can, and kids just want answers and they want to know, am I normal? You know, am I normal? Is how I feel normal? And, you know, we can give them those answers and kids will be okay with that. I think when you see a kid that's more involved in the porn, they probably have not had the balance of discussions and exposures in other places to balance that out.
Yeah, this is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, about sexuality education. Leslie Walker with us, Al Vernacchio with us, and you weighing in on what you think sexuality education in schools should look like. What does it look like in your home? I also want to hear from you if you've had the talk, if you've begun these conversations. And I don't like to say the talk because that sounds like you've had one conversation, that's it, never to be revisited. Have you started some of these discussions with your kids about sexuality? How far are they going? Are you talking mostly about anatomy? Are you bringing in the idea of pleasure and consent and some of these other, sometimes more complicated issues of sexuality? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 to Megan in Shoreview. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I definitely agree with you. It is not just a one-time talk. I have a 10-year-old, and our school district here sent home a notice that they were going to have a talk in fourth grade. And my husband and I sat down, and we presented sex as this is just like your elbow. This is just like teaching your infant, how your body works and how you go to the bathroom and how things like that. So it was more of a facts of life conversation, and this is how the egg and the sperm come together, and everyone has an egg and a sperm, and more factual so that it's not scary. And then opening up and saying, this isn't the last time we're going to talk about this.
Yeah. How did you said your son is 10?
Yes.
How was he with this?
He was listening and silent for a while, and then he had some questions. He had some questions like, well, how does a sperm come out of there? Oh, there was some buy-in from his side that made us know that he was taking this in. And actually, Carrie, when your show came on the radio 20 minutes ago, his ears perked up, and he's like, oh, I forgot to put my shoes on.
And
I said, oh, you've been listening, haven't you?
Uh-huh.
So we'll start talking about pornography next.
Good.
And it's every day, it's when you see a commercial about a razor, a women's razor, but all you see is a naked leg and a body. And I said, what's being sold there?
Mm.
Is sex for sale there, or is a razor for sale there? So bringing it into the everyday conversation is so important as well.
Really good to have your call, Megan. Al, how does that sound like that went to you?
I think Megan gets an A+.
She does, doesn't she? Because she seemed to be open to the questions that her son would have. And that's an important element of that, isn't it?
Yes. And also she's normalizing asking questions about sexuality, talking about sexuality, being curious about sexuality, and all of those model for young people exactly the kind of attitude that will lead them to healthy sexuality. She's provided such a great model, and I'm sure she and her son will have many more conversations, and they'll get increasingly complex as he grows. And the fact that he's willing to ask questions of her really shows that she's done a terrific job.
Susanna called to say that the Unitarian Universalist Church has a great curriculum on sexuality education, thinks that church is a good place to learn about sex and sexuality. Steph off the page.
Katie says, we started with our 3- and 5-year-olds teaching that they're in charge and in control of their own bodies, even when wrestling. And if someone says stop, we stop. We're trying to make it a long and open conversation, not a one-time event. Also trying to capture small things, like when our son acted differently around girls in his class. We tell him it's fun to have crushes, or when either child's exploring their own body, don't freak out and let them know, yes, it feels good. And Ben has an interesting point. He says, if we consider the many cultures and ethnic groups in the Twin Cities in America, traditional sex education may conflict with beliefs within these groups.
Al, I didn't think of that. Could you weigh in on that?
Certainly. Most of the education that I've done has been in religiously oriented schools. I currently teach in a Quaker school run by the Religious Society of Friends. And I think that while certainly we want to always honor the value system that a religious organization may have when it comes to sexuality, we also have to realize that many of the conversations that we have are about healthy development and growth, and that I've never seen a religious institution that didn't want their young people to grow up happy and healthy and able to be in loving, successful relationships. So I think, again, there's much more common ground than we might assume there is. And religious institutions are really an important ally for us in doing this good work.
I want to take a call here from Claire in Minneapolis. Claire, you use a church curriculum, is that right?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually teach at one of the Unitarian Universalist churches, and I think someone had just tweeted in saying that we use the OWL curriculum our whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a lot like what your guests have been talking about, which is looking at sexuality as an entire group. And so we look at gender identity, we look at relationships, we do talk about power and control. And then, of course, we do talk about, you know, masturbation and sex and pornography and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really a focus on everything. And I think one of the things that it's – go ahead.
I was just going to ask you how old the kids are where they begin learning this in church.
Yeah, so the OWL program actually has programs starting with kids at a young age.
Okay.
Our church has a program in fifth grade, and then I teach the eighth grade program.
Okay.
And then there's also high school and young adult.
This is great. It's ongoing.
So clearly the Yeah, exactly. And so clearly a fifth grade conversation is going to look different than an eighth grade or high school conversation. But one of the best things about the program, I think, is the question box where kids can – ask questions without anyone knowing who asked the question.
Mm.
And so that they can get some of those questions like, am I normal? Or how does this really work without maybe saying that in front of their peers?
Yeah. Claire, thanks for the call, especially at that point that we were talking about where religious institutions fit in. Leslie, I'm curious. So I assume that you talk with the kids of some of the patients that you treat. Is that right?
Yep. Pretty much all of the patients.
Okay, so they're all kids.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Yes. Uh-huh.
What's the most common fear or question that these kids have to you?
It depends on the age. I see kids 10 to 24, but in general, it's something around, am I normal? You know, so the younger kids are wondering about their bodies. Is this normal? I'm feeling this way. Is this normal? Is it normal to shave? You know, am I okay if I shave? Some very basic questions. As it gets further along, girls will ask, well, I had this experience, but I didn't feel anything, or I felt bad, or was this something that shouldn't have happened? Is this what rape is called? Or boys will say, you know, I'm not sure, I'm ready for this. What do I do if I'm attracted to both people? How can I talk to my parents about that? I mean, kids, when they're alone and they feel safe, will ask you a lot of questions that may be critical to them feeling, you know, that they're safe and normal and able to have a good life. The other group of kids that we haven't talked about are kids who have mental or physical disabilities. They also have the same questions, the same feelings, the same sexuality, need for, growth and need for education. And a lot of times they don't see any role models. And so it's critical. They have the same, chances to have a bad sex experience, getting pregnant or having infections. There really isn't much of a difference, but they sometimes get much less attention and help in learning how to have that part of their lives be healthy.
Leslie Walker with us from Seattle Children's Hospital. Al Vernacchio with us. He's a sexuality educator at Friends Central School. As we talk about why fewer American teens are getting formal sex education in schools, where your parents fit in on that, where pornography kind of steps in on unwittingly, I guess, on parents' point, educating kids about sexuality. What sexuality education really ought to encompass and where it is age appropriate as kids grow up? And then I'm asking you this morning about the conversations you're having in your own households with your kids. Are you talking about, you know, the basics? Probably you are, anatomy, that kind of thing. Are you also moving into some of these other facets of that conversation about power, the balance of power in a relationship, about pleasure? I'd like to hear how that discussion went for you with your kids. 651-227-6000. By the way, if you get a busy signal, call us back. Lots of phone lines on fire here. 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter. It's at Carrie NPR. We'll get a look at the latest news here. And then at some point in the second half of this discussion, I want to talk about how the Dutch do this. Very interesting model that is not followed in the U.S. So we'll come back on that. Phil, what are you watching this hour?
Hi, Carrie. Police in London say an American woman was stabbed to death during a knife attack last night. Five people wounded in the attack are said to be American, British, Israeli, and Australian. None of them have life-threatening injuries, though. Authorities describe the suspect as a Norwegian teenager of Somali origin, but they say they have no signs of radicalization. The attack came just days after authorities warned the British public to be vigilant in light of attacks inspired by the Islamic State group elsewhere in Europe. President Obama is assessing what's working and what isn't in the fight against the Islamic State group at a time the U.S. military is ramping up its engagement in Libya. The president meets today with military and national security advisors at the Pentagon. Turkey's state-run news agency says a court has issued a formal warrant for the arrest of U.S.-based Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen. The agency says the court issued the warrant today, accusing Gulen of ordering the July 15th coup attempt. The Turkish government says Gulen, who lives in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania, masterminded the failed coup attempt by renegade officers in Turkey's military and wants him extradited to Turkey. The Bank of England has unveiled a series of stimulus measures as it tries to jumpstart an economy shocked by Britain's vote to leave the European Union. The central bank cut its key rate to 0.25% from a previous record low of 0.5%. It's also expanding its bond-buying stimulus program to pump $79 billion in new money into the British economy. French President François Hollande is wasting no time pushing his country as a potential 2024 Olympics host, making an on-site bid in Rio. Hollande flew to Rio today for a series of meetings over 2 days. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:43.
Hey, if you have to step into a meeting, you can't listen to this whole show on sexuality education, you can find it on the podcast. On the podcast right now, The Books the Next President Should Read. Boy, we had a great list come out of that. Dog Days of Summer. And later today, Sexuality Education. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes.
Support comes from Cornerstone Copy Center, full-service printing company for projects of all sizes, including binding, mailers, custom wedding invitations, and more. Cornerstone provides individual service that helps move your project from start to finish. Cornerstone Copy Center. Experience the Cornerstone difference.
Hey, want to let you know that Terry Tempest Williams is with us at 10 o'clock. One of my, I have to say, all-time favorite people to interview. She has a new book out called The Hour of the Land. These beautiful essays about our national parks. And I think you're going to want to weigh in and listen to that. Terry Tempest Williams at 10 o'clock. This conversation about sexuality education. Leslie Walker with us from the University of Washington School of Medicine. And Al Vernacchio with us, the author of For Goodness Sex. And Leslie and Al, I'm just going to go right back to the phones. We have so many questions. Is that okay with you?
Sounds
sure.
Good.
Okay, good. To Grace in St. Paul. Hi, Grace. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just also really grateful that you guys are talking about this important issue. I really feel like this is, you know, a national health issue. The things we don't talk about kids now are going to become issues when they're adults. So thanks for bringing up this topic.
Yeah. I'm glad you're listening.
I am a teacher in St. Paul schools, and I recently had some first graders over the summer. And sex was kind of the last thing that I really thought would come up with them. I'm at that age level. But there were certain small things I'd noticed, such as the boys would very often get into the girls' personal space, not in a sexual way, but just sort of taking that liberty. And the girls were never comfortable, even though you could tell they were uncomfortable. They wouldn't tell the boys to, you know, this is my personal space, I need you to back up. They were very uncomfortable being assertive that way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I found myself having so many conversations with them about you know, respecting people's personal space. And we would role play, the girls and the boys, telling somebody, you're too close, I'm uncomfortable, you need to please back away. Because I just thought, you know, at first grade, if we're already starting here, what's this going to look like when they're 17 or 18 or 19 or in college someday?
Right. Al, what are you hearing that? I mean, she's talking about power to those. They don't know that, but that's going to be an issue through most of their lives.
Absolutely. And talking about power and setting limits and creating boundaries and making deliberate decisions. And also, I love that she is empowering her students and modeling for them how you speak up. When we say to kids, you can say no, but we don't tell them how, we're doing a disservice. So it's great that they were role playing. That's exactly what I think is appropriate for first graders. And they can really learn that way about personal space and boundaries. And then later on, that can be applied to more sexual situations. It's all about building skills.
You know, Al, that's interesting to hear you say that, that you can tell kids to say no, but they often don't know the language for that. I've never really thought about it like that.
Yeah, and so often in our sexuality education classes, we think we're giving kids really clear messages, but we're only giving them part of the information. So, for example, in my class in high school, we practice things like, how do you fight in a relationship? How do you negotiate a situation that might involve sexual activity?
Yeah.
How do you say yes as well as say no? And how can you be in more control of that yes or no? And that does come down to power, and that does come down to recognizing equity and inequity in relationships and in social dynamics.
David Aiken called to say that his wife and he started talking to their kids when they were young with their six-year-old. They're talking about mechanics and anatomy. His oldest is 15, and they're starting to talk about the why, the emotions, and the power aspects of a sexual relationship. Beth says, for sex conversations with kids, I highly recommend the car. You're not looking at each other, and it's a finite talk.
She also put hashtag pro tip.
Yeah,
love that.
She did. Yes. That's right.
Haley says, I went through sex ed in public school not that long ago, and I remember being shown the disease pictures and them trying to push abstinence, but I don't remember them talking about transgender and gay people.
Mm.
And parent of a preteen says, my wife and I talked about sex with our preteen son for the last 2 years with a mixture of science and humor. He is learning to navigate the subject with his peers who often discuss gender and sexuality.
Leslie, we haven't talked about humor. I'll bet you have to use some of that when you're talking to kids in your practice.
Oh, yes, of course. And sometimes, you know, they need to know that it's there's humor and there's fun and in this whole topic. And I think it's real important. I would underscore what Al said, too, about role play. I mean, we know with research that even if you just sit and talk to people and you tell them everything you wanted them to know, kids don't get an effect from that unless they really are going through and practicing the language, practicing how their bodies feel, saying, you know, step back or you know, will you go out? You know, practicing how to do that well is really associated with better long-term effects of working with kids.
Al, are you familiar with what happens in the Netherlands, how the Dutch do this?
Yes, I am. It's a very different model, and it's very effective.
Yeah, will you explain? I know they have this week called Spring Fever, and that's where they have age-appropriate discussions about sex, and they start in kindergarten, and they go all the way up through school. What else do you know about it?
Well, the Netherlands has a much more, I would say, positive attitude towards sexuality, seeing it as a natural and normal part of healthy development. They have sexuality education all throughout the school curriculum. It is they see teenagers not as problems to be solved, but as assets and resources to be given empowerment and good decision making. It's very common, for example, and you know this would never fly in America or not in many houses, but it's very common for a parent from the Netherlands to say to their 16 or 17 year old child, if you're going to be having sex with your sweetheart, I'd so much rather you have it here in your own bedroom where you're safe and a place that you know and where you can feel comfortable as opposed to some place that feels strange or unfamiliar. That's an approach that I don't think is we're ready for in many American households. But I think it's something to really think about in terms of the way we conceive sexual activity in relationships with older teenagers.
And let's emphasize again, their teen pregnancy rates are lower, their STD
Absolutely.
Rates are lower than U.S. rates.
Their abortion rates are lower.
Right. I think we think of the Dutch as permissive, but something is going right there with the way they approach sex.
Yes, and actually, while we might assume they're permissive, they actually do have some pretty clear rules. For example, in Dutch society, it's very clear that sexual intercourse really isn't a behavior for younger teens and younger kids. And they're really clear about that, that it is something that's more appropriate for older teens, that it's also absolutely essential that any sexual activity be protected. So condoms are very easily available. Dutch kids are not afraid to be carrying condoms with them as they go through their day, whereas in America, kids often report someone who carries a condom is either easy or looking for it or somehow they have a negative connotation of that.
Exactly.
So again, many, many differences.
Call here from Eric in Minnetonka. Hi, good morning, Eric.
Good morning. First of all, I just want to say I am just so excited that you guys are covering this important topic.
Well, thank you.
Before I even go, I got to say I'm a proud graduate of the University of Washington, I think you said. And I also am a Unitarian, and my kids went through the OWL program.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And I just got to say that the importance in my mind of education in terms of sexuality. I'm a gynecologist, and I really see that my practice is mostly focused on pelvic pain,
mm-hmm.
and I see the ramifications of inadequate education in terms of my patients' life experiences and the trajectory of their lives being changed. And I can look back 10 years or 20 years and think, if they had known different information at that point, the trajectory of their lives could have been completely different.
Wow.
And so I just want to emphasize again, I just think this is so important. And but I heard somebody talking about pleasure, which mm-hmm. is, I think when you're talking about sexuality with your kids, I think I can't remember exactly the terminology she used, but you know, demystifying it, taking away the fear and talking about the fact that it is pleasurable, so important. But the flip side of that is also to talk about pain. And I think you mentioned that too, but I think it's so important for people to realize young women of all ages and their partners and people who care about women, which is that sex is not supposed to be painful. It's not supposed to be painful. And I'm astonished at the percentage of women I see who never realize that.
Wow.
And they also didn't realize that your periods are not supposed to be painful. And so I do a lot of work with endometriosis. And so if I can use 5 seconds just to say, get the message out. If your periods are painful enough that you cannot do what you want to do, if you can't go to school, you can't engage in activities, it's not normal. You got to get in and see somebody about this, because if you can treat it effectively, it can affect the rest of your life, including your career, your relationships, your sexuality. Look up Padma Lakshmi. She's, the model cooking host that, helped start the Endometriosis Foundation.
Okay.
And it's so important, Carrie. It's so important. Know that sex is not supposed to be painful. Periods are not supposed to be painful. And the more we can do to educate girls and women and the people who care about them, it's so important. It's so important. So I just want to thank you again for covering this topic.
Glad to have your call. Really glad you were listening. Leslie, would you follow up on that?
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. When he was talking, I was thinking about some patients I've had from different cultures, and having the first girl in a family, of many generations of women who lived with pain, and working with that one teen girl and helping them through her, the rest of the women realized that they didn't have to have that. That wasn't the women's curse or the women's, burden to bear, but rather you can have a healthy life without that pain. I do think that that is important, and a lot of people don't talk about it. And we have a very diverse country. And so there are many different people, many different belief systems, and it's important to try to walk that line and help people to understand, even if somebody has a very different belief system about what a woman should feel and when they should feel it and how they should feel it. Pain is something that most people don't want their kids to go through. And if there's a way to alleviate that, you know, most people would want that for their kids. So really helping, again, the education of parents and families and communities on what it means to be a healthy, sexually healthy woman is important.
Al, a good question here on Twitter that I didn't want to miss. How is the decline in sex ed factoring into this research showing young millennials have much less sex? And then she tweeted a Washington Post article that I haven't yet opened, but I will. Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, that article just came out recently. And the fact that millennials are having less sex, certainly I think a lack of sexuality education could contribute to that. I think there are other factors involved in that particularly. But I think that without sexuality education, when young people are going to initiate sexual activity, it's going to be fraught with misinformation and misassumptions, and you know, will really create a negative experience. And for too many young people, their entry into sexual activity is a negative experience. And we really can prevent that. We really can help kids to develop a much more positive approach to this, and that starts with good education in the classroom and at home.
You know, I just flew east to see my mother, and I was talking about this with her, and she was asking me what I remembered about our earliest conversations, because I'm involved in another project about this. And we both, as we compared notes, we both realized that the way she came at this, that conversation that she initially had with me, led us very kind of easily into this idea of an open conversation about how those first sexual experiences should be positive. I mean, Al, I guess I'm saying there was no fear, there was really no warnings, stern warnings around that. And as I look back, I think that made all the difference. Does that make sense to you?
Sure. What a great gift that your mom gave you by giving that approach. And I think when parents are talking to kids about their sexual experiences, which they often worry that kids are going to ask them about, I think it's, you know, start with sharing the story of your first kiss. Start with sharing how you managed your first broken heart or how you dealt with some of your first crushes. Those are the things that young kids are experiencing, and telling our stories to them can really be helpful. And can set up the kind of dynamic that you and your mom had, and you're so fortunate to have had that. Al, she gets an A+ too.
I will pass that on to her. I'll email her today. Hey, Al, really great to have you on the show. Really good to have your insight. Steph off the page.
Rob says, I took each of my boys when they were 13 on a special trip to talk about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I wanted to make sure they had a healthy understanding of sex and told them honestly about my own experience as an awkward teen. Not sure who to believe when it came to sex information.
Leslie, thank you very much for the time. Really good to have you here, too.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. I want to grab a quick call here from Mikey. Mikey, I have about a minute, but I didn't want to miss you. What did you want to say?
Sure. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just quickly, I'm the oldest of six kids, and my brother, who was 13 at the time, all of our siblings were together and respective girlfriends and boyfriends. And so as a result, you've got a different dynamic than parent to child.
Right.
And he was recounting what he expected sex to be like, which was very clearly gathered from pornography in this day and age of tablets and iPhones and everything, which was in one sense very humorous because it was so grossly misinformed. But on the other hand, was very concerning because it was very clear that, you know, as was stated earlier, pornography, in a sense, is like a wrestling match, a pro wrestling match.
And, it's not real.
It's exactly. And he seemed very convinced that what, you know, when I brought up, well, what about protection and diseases? He's like, well, we talked about that in school, but, you know, it wasn't real in a sense in his mind, which I think might be not unique to him. It might be very real to a lot of kids that, hey,
Mikey,
school is kind of lame.
Forgive me here. I have to go. The clock doesn't lie, so I have to wrap the conversation.